Welcome to this IFRS Foundation podcast, which will focus on the March meeting of the International Accounting Standards Board. That meeting took place in London from 12 to 14 March 2019. My name is Matt Tilling. I am a member of the technical staff here at the IASB. Today I am joined by the Chair of the Board, Hans Hoogevorst, and Vice Chair Sue Lloyd to talk through the latest meeting and other developments. Hans, before we talk about the meeting, some big news this week with the announcement of two new board members.
Yes, as people may know, at the end of June, two board members will leave us. Our Brazilian board member, Amaru Gomes, and our Japanese board member, Tak Ochi. And they will be replaced by Tadeu Sandon from Brazil, and Tak Ochi will be replaced by Rika Suzuki, also from Japan. Tadeu Sandon has served as the Director for Professional Development at the Brazilian Institute of Independent Auditors, called IBRACON, and he joins from PwC in Brazil. Where he's currently a partner advising multinational companies that use IFRS standards. Rika Suzuki has been involved with the Japanese Standard Setter, focusing on IFRS implementation, and she has also chaired the Japanese Professional Bodies Working Group on Japan's Modified International Standards. She currently joins from PwC in Japan, and she has also had working experience in the United States. Both of them will start in July, and we look forward to welcoming them to the organization.
Sue, the board meeting started with the classification of liabilities as current or non-current.
Yes, that's right. So the board's been looking at a sort of narrow scope amendment to IAS 1, specifically the classification of a liability as current or non-current. And in this meeting, our most extensive discussion was around the guidance that had been proposed on the circumstances in which equity settlement features would affect the classification of a liability as current or non-current. Some questions came up in response to the exposure draft about the circumstances when you take into account equity settlement and when you don't, and so we agreed on some clarifications on that. We also had a discussion about what happens if a company has, say, a long-term lending agreement, but it would be repayable subject to meeting particular covenants based on financial ratios after the balance sheet date, and how you go about assessing whether or not you've got a right to defer settlement of the liability when the calculation will occur after the reporting date. In the end, actually, we decided not to go into detail on how to make that assessment, to stay more at the principles-based level and for the entity to have to make an assessment of whether or not they have that right to defer as at the settlement date.
Hans, there were two separate projects related to SMEs this month. The first is a new project at the table looking at SMEs that are subsidiaries.
Yes, in terms of the SMEs that are subsidiaries, we are looking into the question whether it would be possible to reduce the burden of full IFRS application for them. So what we would like to look at is if it would be feasible to permit those SMEs that are subsidiaries to apply the full recognition and measurement requirements in IFRS on the one hand, but combined with the disclosure requirements in the IFRS for SME standards, which are much less burdensome than those of full IFRS. So at the moment, the focus is of the staff is to provide the board with evidence to help it decide whether this is feasible and whether we should add a project to our work plan.
And the second project is the comprehensive review of the IFRS for SME standard itself. And it turned into quite a lively discussion.
Yes, so every couple of years we have to look at the IFRS for SME standard to see whether it should be updated for all the new full IFRS standards that have been issued in those years. So we had a discussion which general principles we should apply while doing so. I don't think we came to very precise conclusions, but the main question was to which extent should the IFRS for SMEs reflect full IFRS. And the board has asked the staff to bring back a paper next month that demonstrates how possible principles would be applied to a specific standard so that we can think more practically, more concretely about the best approach going forward.
Sue, any comments to make on the FICE update?
Yes, so we had our first meeting on FICE since we published the discussion paper last year. So the staff brought us the first high-level comment letter summary on the document. Always interesting to get the first look at that. Showed a really diverse range of views, as always. I think overall we got quite strong support for doing some standard setting on this area, but then a whole range of views from limiting ourselves to very targeted amendments to IAS 32 that just deal with known practice issues, all of the way through to some people suggesting we should be starting right back at the concept of what's a liability and reworking aspects of the conceptual framework, and every variant in between. But I think overall we had quite good level of support for the presentation and disclosure requirements that were in that document as well, but where there was more variability in the views was on the specific proposals in that discussion paper on how to determine what's debt and what's equity. And in a couple of months' time we'll start to see more detailed analysis of the comment letter summaries from the staff.
The board also discussed the business combinations under common control, or BCUCC, project this month.
That's right. So it wasn't a decision-making meeting so much. It was more a discussion about information needs. We looked at the information needs of different types of primary users. And in particular, we had an interesting paper on what the information needs were of lenders and creditors, because in the past we've focused mainly on the information needs of non-controlling interests, so equity investors. And it was interesting to contrast and to see whether in fact there might be a case for using the predecessor approach where the focus is on lenders and creditors as opposed to non-controlling interests. So that was an interesting discussion. And for those of you who are interested in this project, actually we had a very good paper that was a PowerPoint style presentation which gave an overview of sort of where we're at in the project, which is a good reference document for anybody interested in catching up on the project. And we'll be continuing these discussions at future meetings, and we'll use these discussions to work out how we move the project forward.
Hans, there was quite a long discussion of primary financial statements, and there were two main topics of discussion. The first of these, the board considered whether additional minimum line items should be added.
Yes, the board decided to require a few extra line items in the statement of financial position, of course only where material. And entities will be, businesses will be required to present in the future a line item of goodwill, which is these days often subsumed in intangible assets and not very clearly visible. And following up on our decisions on the income statement, there will also be a line item that reflects investments in integral associates and joint ventures using the equity method, and investments in what we call non-integral associates and joint ventures, and associates that a business does not consider essential to its business model.
The second issue that you looked at was unusual items.
Yes, so as most people know, currently adjustments for what people will call unusual items or non-recurring items are extremely commonly done in the realm of non-GAAP. And in itself, this is very important information for investors. Investors try to estimate future cash flows, so they are really interested in knowing which parts of expenditures or revenues are one-offs and not likely to recur in the future. Now, in practice, companies have a tendency to focus on what they see as unusual expenses, expenditures, rather than identifying windfall profits. And while it may never be perfectly possible to identify unusual items, we have developed some a definition and some guidance that will strengthen discipline in this area. So I think this will be a very important part of the PFS project.
Sue, can you provide us with an update on insurance contracts?
Yes, so at this meeting we concluded the technical discussions on the potential amendments to IFRS 17 that we've been discussing that have come up in relation to the implementation of the standard. At this meeting we voted to propose two targeted amendments to the standard. One is linked to risk mitigation, and in particular how you deal with transition to the standard where you've been using risk mitigation. And the other was about credit cards that provide insurance. We were talking here in particular about credit cards where, for example, if I bought something on credit and paid £200 on my credit card, but if there was something wrong with the thing that I bought, I could actually claim more than £200 from the credit card provider in accordance with the credit card conditions. And we are going to propose that those types of credit cards with that type of insurance would be in the scope of IFRS 9 rather than the scope of IFRS 17. We also had quite a lengthy discussion about the level of aggregation at which insurance contracts are recognised and measured in accordance with IFRS 17. The board voted to retain the requirements in IFRS 17 as they are, so not to amend them, because we think it provides useful information to investors, particularly about trends and profitability for groups of different insurance contracts. Even though we didn't propose any changes, I really do recommend that people who are interested in IFRS 17 take a look at the three papers that we had on aggregation. I think in addition to a very thorough analysis of an example which illustrated the information content that the board thought was important, there's also two papers which provide detailed background on the way we ended up where we did, if you like, in IFRS 17 with the grouping requirements. And I think it provides really useful background of the history and also explanation of the information that the board is hoping will be achieved by applying those requirements. So it's, I think, helpful reading. Looking forward on insurance, the plan for the April meeting is that the board will be asked to give permission to ballot, which means that the staff will then be starting drafting the proposed amendments, ready for publication as an exposure draft, and we're planning to start the consultation process around the end of June.
Finally, Hans, can you provide us with an update on the IBOR reform project?
Yes, as most people will know, regulators around the world are trying to replace IBOR benchmark interest rates, such as LIBOR, by other benchmark rates, given the level of abuse that have taken place in the past. Now, it's not clear how exactly this will be done, so the exact changeover is not known in many parts of the world, and it may differ around the world. Jurisdictions are working on that at the moment, but there is considerable uncertainty. That might have an impact on the hedging accounting arrangements of banks, especially given that hedging accounting arrangements are based on having certainty in the future about the benchmark rates that you use. If that certainty is no longer there, then if we don't do anything, banks might be forced to terminate their hedging arrangements. So at this meeting, we decided that we will provide relief from the effects of IBOR reform, but also that the application of the relief from the effects of IBOR reform should be mandatory rather than voluntary to create maximum comparability. And we also decided that entities should cease to apply the relief when the earlier of the following occurs. First, that the uncertainty regarding timing and amount of the resulting cash flows is no longer present, or the hedging relationship terminates. So that's the first part of the work. There will be a second phase to the project, which is dealing with accounting after the reform. That work we can only start on when it is clear what the reform will exactly look like. So that is something for the future.
And we also looked at the due process aspects of the IBOR reform. So the board also gave permission to ballot and agreed on the period for exposure. So we agreed that the comment period would be 45 days. So a little shorter than normal, but that's because we really need to get these amendments in place before the end of the year to provide relief to the market on a timely basis.
Thank you, Hans and Sue, and thank you to our listeners. Any feedback on these podcasts, please email communications@ifrs.org. As always, the full summary of the board's discussion and decisions at the March meeting can be found in the ISB update on the IFRS Foundation's website. You can also subscribe to receive new episodes as they become available on iTunes. We look forward to talking with you all again very soon.